that come to the post?
All factors, causes and effects aside, the COVID-19 outbreak would have an unavoidable, uncontested effect on electoral participation anywhere, and by the most reliable findings. Based on data available from Harvard Dataverse, the French municipal elections were studied by Abdel Nouri. These elections took place at the very beginning of the ongoing pandemic and were held in over 9,000 municipalities on March the 15th, 2020. Turnout rates decreased to a historically low level, especially in places where the risk of infection was higher and with people more vulnerable to infection. And so, a robust relationship was established between the depressed turnout rate and the disease. Actually, there is another way of looking at the turnout. For this, I had a chat with Mr. Mohammad Reza Shojaian of Jame Jam Daily for a media man's take on the matter.
There has been a gray spectrum. People who said they were not going to vote, but at the last moment went to the ballots. What I'm saying is that it could be regarded as a component of democracy in the country, because we have a wide range of different thoughts and ideologies in the country. Since our nation isn't ruled by a totalitarian system, as some falsely advertise against the Islamic Republic of Iran, people have the right to vote. We have been given this right. No one went to the ballots at knife point. We must pay attention to that.
Question is, basically, how did Raisi get to win? The question arising I put to Mr. Naghavi, a former MP whom we always interviewed as an articulate political analyst. He received us at his electoral station from where he'd been campaigning to encourage voter participation.
Mr. Raisi was distinct among the seven presidential candidates. One can say that he had a clear advantage over the group. That's because the two reformist candidates, Mr. Mehralizadeh and Hemmati, weren't even endorsed by the reformists. This caused them not to have any motivation to engage in the competition or go to the polls. Or, for example, Mr. Hemmati was considered a low-tier candidate of the executives of Construction Party. Among the principalists, also Mr. Ghazizadeh, Zakani and Jalili were closer to a possible presidency. But Mr. Raisi was head and shoulders above them in terms of his experience and background.
Predictions were kind of spot on, and polls were mostly not far off from actual results, although not all polls predicted a turnout of under half the electorate. The electorate having been almost 59.5 million people eligible to vote, almost 1.4 million of whom were allowed to vote for the first time. In addition, around 3.5 million Iranian expatriates were also eligible to vote in 133 diplomatic Iranian missions in foreign lands.
The simple fact is that we didn't have the excitement we witnessed in the elections of 2017, 2013, 2005 or 1997. The excitement in those elections was tremendous. The turnout was over 70-80%. But this was a good election in its own right. About 48% of the eligible voters participated, which isn't unacceptable compared to other democratic systems. Although the elections are always filled with excitement and have 70-80% turnouts, 48% isn't too satisfactory for our people. But it's a good figure compared to other democratic systems.
A certain level of reduction in the turnout might actually not be a bad thing. Maybe that could serve as a wake-up call and a positive signal to our statesmen. We need to admit that over the past decade, we missed several opportunities, which created a level of mistrust among the people. Maybe what happened in this election could serve as a turning point for our statesmen to come to their senses and increase the turnout in the next races.
As for what Raisi is going to do with his win when he actually takes hold of the reins in about a month and a half, he is likely to have a major effect on Iran, although major foreign policy decisions will require a green light by the president's superior. That's leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Generally, decisions on that scale are made by consensus by the Supreme National Security Council, which does feature a strong presence also by the president and leader. In his first press conference, President-elect Ebrahim Raisi highlighted his high-priority executive policies for the country, in responding to questions by local and foreign journalists. The highlights were as such.
The basic commodities are a priority for the new government. Monitoring the supply chain from production until consumption will definitely be the government's priority. However, the bottom line is that we need to put an end to the relationship between people's livelihoods and the basic commodities and the dollar, or the issues happening outside the country in mid and long term, so that our nation would become self-sufficient in supplying the basic commodities. The message of the Iranian nation was the necessity of a change in the economic situation. In the meantime, I emphatically urge the United States to return to the JCPOA and comply with this commitment. The Iranian people expect you to abide by your obligations. This is our plan, and we will kick it off from the very beginning to promote the nation's self-sufficiency in producing the basic commodities, God willing. This vast and meaningful presence of the people occurred in spite of the coronavirus situation and hostilities and the psychological warfare of Iran's enemies. Anyone whose heart beats for the people and the revolution will be our partner everywhere in the country.
I asked what challenges Raisi would have to prioritize.
JCPOA would be something important, but during debates he emphasized the fact that Iran needs to work more with its neighbors. So one way of going around sanctions is to do more in the neighborhood, so you don't have to worry about sanctions as much. And working with countries that like to work with Iran. Not all countries are Western in the world. And non-Western countries generally like to work with Iran. So increasing relations with non-Western countries is going to be another of his priorities.
We popped out to see what people on the street thought of the president-elect.
Mr. Raisi spoke with people with honesty and didn't make empty promises like the other politicians.
We hope he can at least help us get out of the current situation a bit.
People were disappointed in the previous government and in fact thought to themselves that let's give another camp a chance, maybe they'll succeed.
The question must be whether Mr. Raisi has the capability to bring people into the equation, which I think he does. I'll say it frankly that he must believe that we can get anything done without having to be dependent on any country, and that we can make an ideal nation with a dynamic economy very easily.
Every time an administration takes office, it begins to make promises, but as problems arise later on due to the sanctions, it can't do its job as it should.
He had a set of personality traits and also his track record in the judiciary, which gave people hope that he can address some of the problems the country is facing and surmount the obstacles.
Mr. Raisi must join forces with the elite, the people who are smart and educated, people who've suffered and tasted pain to build Iran and save it from the crisis. In my opinion, he has the power to do that.
Today's is not a topic specific to any one outlet or country. So let's make a quick diversion to see what other media outlets, domestic and foreign, have to say about Iran's elections. Here's to put them in words. The Financial Tribune starts out by announcing Raisi's election as president. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on Saturday, June the 19th, expressed gratitude to the people who headed to the polls in large numbers despite economic woes, the COVID-19 pandemic, and foreign pressure. Nothing could overcome the Iranian people's determination, he said. The big winner of yesterday's election are the Iranian people. The spectacular sights of your gatherings and polling stations across the country was a clear sign of your firm resolve and hope. President Hassan Rouhani and Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf separately visited Raisi in his office to congratulate him in person. Starting today until 45 days from now, when the country's responsibilities are transferred to the new government, I will stand by the president-elect, Rouhani said. The president promised a smooth transition of power and instructed his cabinet to fully cooperate with Raisi's team. In his televised victory speech released later in the day, Raisi stated, "I will do everything in my power to solve the country's problems, especially in regard to people's livelihood challenges." The Tehran Times quotes the Rouhani administration's foreign minister, Zarif. Zarif says all must back President-elect Raisi, predicts JCPOA would be revived in Rouhani administration. Speaking on the sidelines of Antalya Diplomacy Forum on Saturday, June the 19th, Zarif also described Raisi as a reasonable man who can govern the country. When asked about the recent arguments in the presidential debate, Zarif considered these arguments as a sign of liveliness in political atmosphere of Iran, saying, "We are way ahead of most countries in the region in terms of having a lively political debate." Zarif also predicted that the JCPOA, the official name for the 2015 nuclear deal, would most likely be revived during the remaining term of Hassan Rouhani's administration. We've got Mehr news pointing to a message from a foreign dignitary to Ebrahim Raisi. Iraq hopes of expansion of mutual relations with Iran, Saleh. Iraqi President Barham Saleh on Saturday, June the 19th, said that his country hopes for developing and expanding relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran during Raisi's tenure. He made the remarks in a telephone conversation with Iranian President-elect Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi and reiterated that his country is very interested in expanding and broadening relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Turning to the age-old and long-standing relations between the two countries of Iran and Iraq, he said, "We had good memories of your recent trip to Iraq, and we hope to expand and broaden our bilateral relationship." In his phone talk, Iraqi President Barham Saleh congratulated Ayatollah Raisi as president-elect of the Islamic Republic of Iran and wished him ever more success and prosperity in his new tenure. And that would be it for the news segment. Do stay with us. While Raisi is a familiar face with a well-publicized policy agenda, civil unrest sparked by economic hardship brought on by U.S. sanctions, political corruption, and COVID-19 remains a possibility to take care of. Mostly the principalist portion of the public, as well as townships and rural areas, have shown by their vote that they are giving the president a chance to amend affairs peacefully by good administration and a firm hand. The revival of the nuclear deal or JCPOA by ongoing talks still by the outgoing administration can ease Iran's domestic economic woes to a point and reposition the country on the international scene. The JCPOA Vienna talks are on to their sixth round now.
Now that we are in a time of peace, perhaps the most important challenge we face is the economic and with respect to housing and unemployment of the youth, especially the educated ones. Unfortunately, we have a great number of educated youth who are unemployed. We have a kind of hidden unemployment too, meaning that the worker is paid a puny sum, doesn't have insurance, or the job status fitting his level of education. The sense of mistrust has dramatically increased in the markets, compounded by the hourly and daily increase of the price tag of the goods.
Here's what marks our guest would give to the legacy passed down by the Rouhani government, which, to give them credit, did sign the JCPOA, although maybe without the necessary safety valves.
I can't even grade Mr. Rouhani's administration's performance, because he failed to take advantage of opportunities that arose. He devoted all his energy to promoting ties with the West and forgot all the neighbors and economic powers in the world. The Chinese were furious after the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA. We talked with China. They were upset, citing the agreement we signed and the investment they made in our oil and gas sector. They said the moment the JCPOA was reached, you threw us all out and replaced us with Shell and Total. Now go work with them if you still can. We can't score the administration's performance. Or take the economy, for example, which saw its worst recession.
However, the world is expecting to see significant shifts by the principalist presidency at the domestic level. Although Mr. Raisi has said he wants to be leader to the whole nation, left or right, young or old, While fighting the endemic economic corruption, I asked how realistic the president-elect's presidential mottos were.
You know, he spent all his life fighting corruption. He was a judge for many, many years. And that was the main theme of his election campaign. So he would want to do some of the promises that he made. And this is going to be something that he would be interested in engaging in. You know, they come, these clerics like him, come from that liberation theology school of thought that started the Islamic Revolution. Clerics that believe they have a role in society, they need to take care of the poor, they need to have social programs.
I believe the upcoming cabinet would consist of young and at the same time expert ministers. A cabinet that's not lethargic and always behind closed doors. Or one that if people want to have an appointment with a minister, they wouldn't have to go through several stages and people like office managers or security guards. Some of the former ministers said they had to wait for up to several months for an appointment with the president to talk about something like a development project.
Now, who is Raisi, the man? The now 61-year-old, born in a northeastern village of Khorasan province, became prosecutor of Karaj, a city close to Tehran, at age 20, with clerical qualification. Only 5 years later, he was promoted to deputy prosecutor of the Revolution, Court of Tehran, which he served until 1989. He continued in major judicial roles until 2015, when he found himself in the influential position of custodian of Arslan Quds, that's a religious foundation close to his hometown. This helped him establish a strong base in rural areas. He set his sights on the presidency soon after and lost to Rouhani in 2017. His vote was considerable, however.
Taking a look at his resume, as far as I can remember, when he was a custodian of Arslan Quds Rezavi, he was really active in sport-related projects. There were a couple of lands where construction was halted during the current or the previous administration's terms. He is a director and not someone who will sit behind a desk. He removed the obstacles in the way of the construction, building a hospital and a soccer stadium, which is now one of the most modern ones in the country. These examples are the smallest scales of what he is capable of. If you generalize this to the management of the country, you can expect positive effects on the political and economic future of the country.
After losing the 2017 election, Ayatollah Khamenei appointed Ebrahim Raisi head of the judiciary in 2018. Raisi then vowed to root out corruption, and that remains a major presidential promise of his. That is tangible and palpable domestically, but the international community, rather the West, especially the US and Israel, remain to see if Raisi will differentiate between US President Biden and Trump. Americans would expect a more fiery rhetoric, even as the outgoing presidency hopes to revive the nuclear deal, and although it has become the general policy of this country to do so. The Iranian president is determined through an absolute majority of 50% plus one of the votes. With no absolute majority, the law calls for a runoff election between the top two presidential contestants to be held within 1 week of the first round of elections. Once a winner is determined, the Constitutional Council approves the election process and the leader signs off on the letter of presidency. The new president must then take an oath of office before parliament or majlis. The West may not be positive about the vote principalist Raisi made his in a contest against two other principalists and one moderate, Hemmati. But he has been congratulated for a presidential win by an array of countries, West and East, and dignitaries and movements regional. Given the city and village council elections were held at the same time as presidential elections, Tehran City Council candidates with the highest vote were also announced. Monday, June the 21st, that is. They're all principalists, which means the council is once again after 4 years in the hands of this faction, the right. Among the most important faces of those elected is Mehdi Chamran, a famous principalist and former Tehran City Council chief, who didn't win the vote last round. And also, Narges Soleimani, daughter of General Soleimani, Results show people voted for name lists rather than individual candidates. The most important responsibility city councils have, next to taking care of city and citizen affairs, is to elect the mayor and supervise his performance. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. But do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after, as there's bound to be surprises, as there are unfinished discussions. Till then, bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In California, gun violence costs the state approximately $22.6 billion each year, with $1.2 billion falling on the shoulders of taxpayers. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Grace Hayes titled, "A Mass Shooting Prompted a California Mayor to Take Action. He Couldn't Stop Another One." The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay tuned. On July 28, 2019, a gunman opened fire on a crowd at Gilroy Garlic Festival, killing 6-year-old Stephen Romero, 13-year-old Kayla Salazar, and 25-year-old Trevor Irby, and injuring 17 others. The mass shooting sent shockwaves through the community, located 30 miles south of San Jose in California's Bay Area, as it elicited all too familiar calls from elected officials that thoughts and prayers were no longer a sufficient response. Among them was San Jose's mayor, Sam Liccardo, who 2 weeks later unveiled a first-of-its-kind proposal that would require gun owners in the U.S. 10th largest city to buy liability insurance for their weapons. Those that didn't buy the insurance would be required to pay a fee to cover the cost of gun violence in the city. But in 22 months following the announcement, the initiative failed to make it in front of the San Jose City Council. On the morning of May 26, a 57-year-old Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority maintenance worker shot and killed 9 of his co-workers at a transit agency's rail yard in San Jose before killing himself. In the weeks following, Liccardo lurched back into action, re-announcing his gun insurance proposal with the addition that paying a fee would be required by all gun owners, regardless of whether or not they purchased insurance. The city council passed a law first proposed by the mayor in February 2019 that mandates gun stores to record the sale of weapons and ammunition. The road to passing meaningful gun legislation in San Jose has been a long one. Ricardo, for his part, blames the delays on the pandemic, as the health experts who were supposed to study the cost of gun violence became overwhelmed as the coronavirus spread through the Bay Area. And he pointed at legal minefield the city's team of attorneys has had to navigate as they determined how to enact a gun insurance mandate no city in the country had tried before. But the drawn-out process in San Jose points to a broader trend: the extreme difficulty in enacting comprehensive gun legislation in the United States even after mass shootings. San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo said, when episodes of mass shootings happened in New Zealand or Australia or the UK, those governments took the responsibility to say, we are going to take measures that will reduce gun violence significantly in our community, adding, the result was a dramatic reduction in gun harm. It should not surprise anyone that in a country where we seemingly lack the will to do much of anything substantial to really reduce gun violence in our country, that it takes a horrible tragedy. Christopher Polikin, an assistant professor of strategy at UCLA's Anderson School of Management, said, faced with Republican opposition, gun control legislation has historically failed in the U.S. Congress, even following mass shootings. Instead, most gun policy, whether that be the loosening or tightening of restrictions, has been enacted by state legislatures. Polikin added, most initiatives on gun restrictions follow mass shootings, despite the prevalence of everyday community gun violence in the country. Polikin said overall mass shootings made up just 0.2% of all gun deaths in the U.S. in 2019, yet high-profile attacks tend to have the most impact on policymakers. Liccardo likens his gun insurance mandate to other harm reduction strategies that have helped decrease the smoking and injuries and deaths from car collisions. The insurance would cover accidental discharges and intentional acts by someone who borrowed, stole, or otherwise acquired a gun. However, it would not cover costs associated with intentional acts of gun violence by the gun owner. City officials have yet to determine how much the fee to help cover the cost of the gun violence in San Jose will be, but the money will pay for police and other emergency services strained by gun-related injuries and deaths. In California, gun violence costs the state approximately $22.6 billion each year, with $1.2 billion falling on the shoulders of taxpayers. If San Jose passes Liccardo's gun insurance proposal, the policy could have ripple effects on other cities across California, as other mayors have already expressed interest in enacting similar legislation. But first, it will have to withstand legal scrutiny as Second Amendment groups prepare to sue San Jose. Sam Pardi, the executive director of Gun Owners of California, expects the mayor will have his rear end handed to him in a basket by the courts. Pardes said of gun owners, they are allowed to exercise an enumerated right in the Constitution, adding, you can't force an insurance policy against an enumerated right. The threat of legal action is a part of the terrain of gun control in the U.S., and in most states, local lawmakers' hands are tied on the issue due to preemption laws. These laws prevent local governments from regulating guns in certain areas, such as licensing or permitting. California is just one of the two states with limited firearm preemption laws, and five states have no preemption law at all. Allison Anderman, senior counsel at Gifford Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, said the gun lobby has spent decades working to make it so that local jurisdictions don't have the freedom to govern on this issue and take the steps they feel are necessary to protect their communities, adding, this is obviously so that newer cities or more liberal cities in more conservative states aren't going to do what the state legislature won't do and limit gun access, because that's not good for gun industry profits. Even if the gun insurance proposal overcomes the legal test, Liccardo himself recognizes that it is unlikely to stop a mass shooting from happening again in San Jose. Instead, he says it will enable the city to identify high-risk gun owners. Liccardo says if any officer responding to a domestic violence call in the home finds that there is a gun without insurance, it provides an opportunity for the officer to seize the gun on site. He added that's actually really important because that's a particular context where we know gun possession is highly correlated to gun violence. Anderman, who has been working with Licardo's office on the gun insurance policy, agrees that the scope of harm that it could ameliorate is fairly narrow. However, it will provide victims of gun violence with a monetary compensation they may not otherwise receive. Next month marks the 2-year anniversary of Gallery Garlic Festival shooting, and the families of those killed are still grappling with the trauma of that day. Katyusha Pimol Vargas remembers her niece, Kayla, as resilient, sweet, and generous. Before the gunman cut her life short, the 13-year-old saved up her birthday money to buy her friends ice cream from the Pelrose, where their parents were short on cash. She loved art and animals. Vargas said it was disappointing to see San Jose wait this long to take action. Still, she wants others to know that there are people behind the numbers, that Kayla isn't just a number, but one of the more than 14,000 who died from gun violence in 2019. Vargas said, "We just want people to remember what happened so we don't forget the pain that families continue to go through," adding, "I don't want another family to live through what we have been through."
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has decided to add the Yemeni resistance movement, Ansarullah, to its annual blacklist of parties violating children's rights. Now, this is happening while the ongoing war on Yemen and the continuous Saudi blockade is taking its toll on civilians, mostly women and children. In this edition, we will be scrutinizing the different aspects of this decision with a look at the bigger picture. But first, a report.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement blamed the United Nations for the Saudi atrocities committed against Yemeni children. The movement said the UN has always been providing the political cover-up for the Saudi war crimes. This came after the United Nations added the Ansarullah movement to its blacklist of groups for violating children's rights.
We were not surprised by this decision because the UN had removed the name of Saudi Arabia from its blacklist of the groups violating children's rights. The United Nations have not taken any real steps to protect the rights of Yemeni children who die every day due to continued blockade on food, medicine, and fuel. I believe that this is a resounding scandal for the Secretary General of the UN, who began his second term with this decision.
The member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, dismissed as baseless the UN accusation, saying it did not refer to an investigation on the ground as the movement has demanded. Meanwhile, the Minister of Information said the UN has turned a blind eye to the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemenis, which causes the death of tens of Yemeni children on a daily basis.
This classification wasn't based on realistic data. We used to have the United Nations as a political cover for the war on Yemen and the killing of more Yemeni women and children, whether because of the continuous Saudi blockade or because of the airstrikes of Saudi fighter jets. This decision revealed to the world the true face of the United Nations, that it serves the agenda of the countries funding the UN.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and turned the war-torn country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the United Nations blacklisting of Ansarullah is politically motivated and has no relation to the humanitarian situation in Yemen. They believe that the UN must take real actions against the Saudi blockade if it has real intentions to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Now to continue this discussion, we're joined by Mr. Hamza Shaiban, Yemeni activist and political commentator out of Sana'a, and also Ms. Judith Bello, senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement. Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with Mr. Shaiban. Now, how do you think this decision will impact the UN and particularly its international image?
Thank you for having me. Unfortunately, the UN continues to be a platform for countries like the US and help them to provide a political cover. Unfortunately, such a move is not based on reality, and basically it's based on falsified reports or politically motivated. We all remember the war crimes and the atrocities that the Saudi US coalition has committed in Yemen. There are thousands of clips that were documented showing dead children who are half torn sometimes, but nevertheless this did not motivate the UN to put Saudi Arabia or US in the blacklist. We all remember the incident that happened in Saada and Dahyan, where a school bus was bombed and the two children were killed. In Yemen now, every 75 seconds a child dies because they don't have access to food or clean water. And this is according to the director of the food program in Yemen, World Food Program.
And what you just mentioned
you
is a direct
this
result.
This is not different from.
What you just mentioned is a direct result of the Saudi blockade on Yemen, isn't it?
Absolutely. Today in Yemen, more than 80% of the population is in need of humanitarian assistance. This is because of the blockade that is imposed by US and Saudi Arabia on Sana'a's airport and Hodeidah port. Back to this move, I believe this is no different from what happened in 2016 when Secretary General Ban Ki-moon enlisted Saudi Arabia in the blacklist of groups that violated children's rights in Yemen. And Saudi Arabia, after that, threatened them that they would cut the funds that they gave them, which was approximately, I think, 100 million. A week or so after that, they had to take them off the list because, according to Ban Ki-moon, he said that they were put under pressure by Saudi Arabia that they would cut the funds. Again, this is something that definitely is not surprising from a UN, from an international institution like the UN, who should be credible. Nevertheless, they tend to be not neutral in this war, and they're not playing a very positive role in the war in Yemen. I believe that if Yemen had money and they could pay the UN, they wouldn't have been they wouldn't have enlisted Ansarullah movement in this list. We all saw what UN provided to the children in Syria, to the children in Lebanon, to the children in Palestine, most importantly. Definitely this is just a continuation of a negative role that UN is playing when it comes to protecting and providing political cover for countries like U.S. and Israel.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Shaiban. You actually pointed out some very interesting issues, and also that flashback to the time when Saudi Arabia paid the U.N. The U.N. actually took Saudi Arabia off the list because it was worried about the payments that it was receiving from Saudi Arabia. Let's bring in Judith Bello. Ms. Bello, if you could please tell us what you think. Is the UN chief actually serious in bringing peace to Yemen?
I don't think the UN is serious about its response to Yemen at all. They are behaving as a proxy for the Western powers right at the moment. The only base they have down there, the United Nations, through which all the food and resources have to come into Yemen, is on a U.S. base in Djibouti. So they basically have deferred to the Western assault on Yemen, and they're riding it out rather than rejecting it. And the Saudis, the U.S. has given complete cover to the Saudis, even though they now have some stuff going on in Congress in opposition to it. The U.S. government is not terribly interested in what the people want, and they obviously have doubled down on their support of the Saudis in this matter. I think it's really a crime that it's going on the way it is, and the United Nations gives legitimacy to this nothing government of Mr. Hadi in Saudi Arabia, while at the same time they do not give legitimacy to Ansarullah, who are defending their country. And I think this right there says it all, that the United Nations in this particular matter, and they have had moments when they did a little bit better, although not frequently or not every time, in this particular matter, the United Nations is totally co-opted by their, not just Saudi money, but their major benefactor, which is the United States.
Now, Ms. Bell, Antonio Guterres is actually blacklisting Ansarullah as a party violating children's rights. Interestingly, we have witnessed Saudi Arabia and its allies purposefully targeting children. We've seen school buses being targeted by the Saudi.
Let me just say one more thing about this. You know, during the Iran-Iraq war, Saddam Hussein was mercilessly using chemical weapons on Iran and the Iranian people, and they were also using them on their own people in the Kurdish areas in the north of Iraq. And while they were doing this, Iran repeatedly, this is against the United Nations rules, so Iran repeatedly went to the United Nations and said, first they were the aggressors, and now they're attacking us with these illegal weapons. And the best that the United Nations could do, again, because this was a U.S.-instigated war, the best the United Nations could do was to condemn, quote unquote, both parties. And they never did single out the actual perpetrator of these atrocities. And this is a problem with the UN. The United States does not live in the real world. It lives in the world of what it wants, and it will do or say anything. When I say it, I mean the blob, the Washington blob or whatever, not necessarily the people of America. But they will do whatever they want to oppress and humiliate those who they want to overcome. And they've done this to Bashar Assad. They did it in Libya. They done with the horrific murder of Gaddafi, the president at the time. And they're doing it in Yemen by refusing legitimacy to the one group that is broadly defending the country. They did it in Gaza with Hamas. They found a way to blame them. Like if Hamas, you know, retaliates against an Israeli attack, then all the deaths that come from it are Hamas's fault. This goes on and on, and I don't know the answer to it. I know that it's an evil policy, very hard to work with the American government because, as I say, they really don't care what the people think. And they, as Mr. Pompeo said a few years ago, they lie, cheat, and steal. That's their training. And they do whatever it takes. And I am very glad that Ansarullah is there defending their people. I'm not sure what this will cost them. I think it costs them what they already don't have, which is the control of incoming resources. Because what happens, of course, from the very beginning, the way the blockade works is that Saudi allies and United Arab Emirates allies get food, get the things that they need, get weapons, and Ansarullah and the people of the majority of the people of Yemen go without, because that's part of the strategy of the war. And by doing this, it's just, in my opinion, it's sort of rubbing their nose in the dirt. It's a deliberate attempt to humiliate them and to, in some ways, maybe prop foolish enough to believe whatever the UN says. But the bottom line is that stopping them is a big problem. And Ansarullah has fought long and hard, and they've had some gains, and they're making some progress against the Saudis. So we just have to hope that in their persistence and in their connection with other countries fighting for their lives against the same group, in connection with the Palestinians, in connection with the Lebanese, which under Hezbollah, in connection with the Syrians, that if the people of the region stand together and persist, that eventually the world will retreat. That there won't be a choice to persist.
Hopefully, Ms.
Because this is so wrong.
I'm sorry to cut you off. Let's bring in Mr. Chabon, since you mentioned the U.S. Mr. Chabon, the U.S. is providing logistics and arms to Saudi Arabia to continue this war on Yemen. Why doesn't that result in any serious measures from the U.N.?
Sorry, why doesn't that
result in any serious measures from the U.N.? The U.S. is actually providing the arms, the logistics, everything for Saudi Arabia and its allies. We don't see the U.N. condemning the U.S. for that.
Yeah, as I mentioned, unfortunately, the UN is acting like a platform and providing political political cover for US and other countries to do whatever they want. They basically gave them a free check to do whatever they want in Yemen, in Palestine, and in Syria as well. I truly believe that UN cannot be. As an international institution, UN is not a neutral party when it comes to defending victims and condemning the aggressors. As long as they're getting funds from Saudi Arabia, as long as US is supporting them in a way or another, they will continue doing whatever they want to do. And UN will just, try to beautify their image, U.S. image, and keep providing them with excuses to implement their agenda in the region, which is destabilizing these countries and making sure that they're not independent and they don't take a stance against their agenda in the region.
Ms. Donald. Because of these different aspects that we have been mentioning so far during our show, Yemen's Ansarullah has slammed the decision of Antonio Guterres, calling it disgraceful. Do you believe that this view is shared by many across the world?
I actually do believe it's shared by most of the developing nations in the global south. I do not think any of them are fooled by the behavior of the United States and Saudi Arabia's case. And that is a reason for hope in a matter like this, because much of the world sees through these actions by the United Nations and by the United States. And they are resentful of countries like Saudi Arabia. The United States blames other countries for having dictatorships while ignoring the abuses in Saudi Arabia and the murders of people that happen there at the royal discretion and so on. So I think that this is our strongest positive that we have going for us in creating a better world, is that the countries of the global south are not fooled. They all understand what's happening here, and they are gradually building their strength.
And let's not forget, Ms. Bello, let's not forget that we live in a day and age that with all of these mobile phones and different tools that people have, it's very difficult for mainstream media to shape public opinion as it used to decades ago. And it's, of course, more difficult to hide the truth. So how far do you think the UN can go?
To be honest, I don't know how far they can go. I do think that they lack legitimacy even here in the United States, because so many people feel that the United Nations has been co-opted. people continue to try to work with the United Nations because it's the only global forum that we have. And so they pass resolutions to do things that are often ignored, like the ones against nuclear proliferation or the ones against, other kinds of weapons or in support of human rights. And even though these are abused at the moment by the United States and nations, it remains that it's a global platform. And I think that's really the only legitimacy it has here, even in the United States, because it's been under attack. And that's one of the problems. You know, you have the United States destroys its tools.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chabon. Could we hope for any change in the UN chief's angle towards this issue? Could we hope for any change in the UN chief's angle towards this issue?
Now, this depends on, whether the UN is actually trying to show the truth about what's happening in, in Yemen, or whether they're trying to justify whatever the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are trying to do. As long as the UN is being backed by Saudi petrodollars and U.S., I don't really think that anything will change.
And
the war in Yemen has been going on for almost 7 years.
Thank you very much. We're running out of time, so I would like to have Ms. Bello's response on this question as well. Ms. Bello, do you believe that we could expect any change?
I think there's some potential for change just in the shifting of international strength in terms of the growing strength, for instance, of China in global politics and other things that are happening that actually weaken the United States. So I think there's some possibility, but I don't see any immediate relief on the horizon, because this entire war in Yemen has from the beginning been under at least the outside external control of the United States, and the United Nations has been submissive to the U.S. agenda all along. So I guess I think long term that there's potential for relief, but not short term.
So we have to keep and continue making programs like this to raise more awareness, to get people to know what exactly is happening. Thank you very much to both of our guests, Hamza Chabon, a Yemeni activist and political commentator out of Sana'a, and Ms. Judith Bello, senior member.